You're listening to Zeigler Group's Legal Zeitgeist podcast, the Funds Law podcast series that helps asset management firms reevaluate and revolutionize their current approach to investment funds law with the latest technology, legal and regulatory compliance insights, and best practices.
Hi, I'm Kate Horgan, Business Development Manager at Zeigler Group. And today I'm joined by my US colleagues, Madeline Gegg and Alex Mercer, associates in our Phoenix office. On today's episode, we will be delving into the intricate web of the US regulatory landscape. Madeline and Alex, thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us, Kate.
Yep, glad to be here, Kate.
Firstly, to kick things off, can you enlighten me on the different regulatory bodies in the US and where and when would firms need to register and comply with each respective regulator?
Sure, Kate, I can go over that. At a high level, there are three sources of regulators in the United States. You have federal regulator, state-level regulators, and what are called self-regulatory organizations, or SROs. Who you register with and who you listen to really depends on what you're doing and where you're doing it. The most common split in this area would be, for example, if you're a registered investment advisor or a broker-dealer, your main regulator would vary depending on your registration status or if you're registered as both. At a federal level, we have two really key regulators in the space. We have the SEC, or the Securities and Exchange Commission, and the CFTC, or the Commodities Future Trading Commission. If you're a registered investment advisor, the SEC will actually be your main regulator, whereas the CFTC handles more issues that are common with commodity pool operators or other forms of more intricate financial devices. On top of that, you also have to be concerned with state-level regulators. Each state have their own specific rules, variances in specifically in how they're implemented, as well as how you comply with them. Now, depending on what services your firm offers, it can really change whether or not the state regulator has jurisdiction over what you do. The most common split with this is, once again, with registered investment advisors, in which if you are an investment advisor with under $100 million in assets under management, you wouldn't actually be regulated by the SEC, but rather by the state-level regulator. Now, there are exceptions to this rule. For example, New York, where if you're over $20 million in assets under management, they defer to federal regulation. But by and by, most states have at least some level of regulation, especially if you're a smaller player in the area. On top of that, you have to be concerned with self-regulatory organizations depending on your registration status. For example, if you're a broker-dealer, your main regulator is actually FINRA, which is the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. The most important thing to understand is that there are multiple regulators and that you have to closely look at what you do to fully understand who might be interested in what you're doing. You can't really just assume that because you're good with one regulator that you'd be good with other applicable regulators, but you can typically find similar businesses and understand what kind of regulatory structure they have and follow them closely.
I'd also really like to add that there's different ways in which people and advisors can interact with these different levels of regulatory industries. So, for example, the SEC, which is also sometimes referred to as the Commission, they have their online platform, which is called EDGAR. That's where they do most of their online filings. They also have several other online platforms for specific forms. But then on the other hand, for broker dealers, FINRA has its own online database for filings and for updating regulatory forms. So it's important to ensure that not only you're interacting with the correct regulators, but also with their correct distribution and interfaces.
Thank you, Alex and Madeline, for such a great overview. There's certainly a lot for firms to navigate, and it's by no means an easy task. In terms of the US regulatory landscape, what are the core regulations that serve as a bedrock of the regulations that investment advisors and financial institutions need to comply with?
Sure, Kate. So when we think about regulation in the US, at its core, we have our federal regulation, which is kind of seen as the bedrock and foundation of, you know, the laws that we have to follow. And for that one, I would say there are three main laws and three main acts that we really do consider. The first would be the Securities Act of 1933. The second would be the Investment Advisor Act of 1940. And the third would be the Investment Company Act of 1940 as well. For the Securities Act, that's commonly referred to as the Truth in Securities Law. It has two main objectives: to require that investors receive financial and other significant information concerning securities before they're being offered for public sale, and to kind of prohibit deceit, misrepresentation, and other fraud in the sale of securities.
Thanks for that, Alex. I'm going to go ahead and move on to the Investment Advisor Act of 1940. So the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 regulates and defines the roles and responsibilities of the actual individual investment advisor. That can be whoever is registered as the RIA. It can be an individual or a firm itself. The Act imposes an affirmative duty of utmost good faith and full and fair disclosure of material facts. Since the Act was amended in 1996 and 2010, generally only advisors with at least $100 million in U.S. dollars asset under management, or if they advise a registered investment company, must register under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. Additionally, investment advisors are required to pass a qualifying exam and register with a regulatory body. So that regulatory body can be the SEC, as we mentioned before, or it might also pertain to the particular state regulatory bodies. I'd also like to point out that kind of the overall purpose and context of all of the three acts that we're going to be talking about: the Securities Act, this Investment Advisors Act that I just spoke on, and we're about to get to the Investment Company Act of 1940. I would just like to add a little context. If we're looking at the years that they were enacted, 1933, 1940, this is right in the middle of the Great Depression. So when you think about the context of these acts, you think about protecting the public and protecting the investors from any kind of malpractice in the investment and security spheres. And then, Alex, would you like to take us away with the Investment Company Act of 1940?
Certainly. So the last of our three acts, the Investment Company Act of 1940, regulates the formation of investment companies and their activities. So at its core, it's a disclosure act. It requires investment companies to disclose their financial condition and their investment policies to investors. But notably, it doesn't actually permit the SEC to directly supervise the investment decisions or their activities, or even judge the merits of their investments. The main point of the act is basically to ensure that information is given and disclosed to the public, and the public is able to use that information when making their investing decisions.
You know, understanding the rules is one thing and adhering to them is another. Let's explore how these regulatory entities enforce these core regulations.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's kind of two primary categories of enforcement mechanisms, and I'll talk specifically here about the SEC, but the same principles kind of apply across several different regulatory entities. So the division lies between civil remedies and administrative remedies. I'll start first with civil remedies. So the SEC is able to file a complaint with a U.S. district court or even recommend an investigation be opened against a party for potential violations of the federal securities law. Something that's important to note here is that all of these acts that we just previously went over and other securities laws are federal level, so they must be enforced through federal courts. Through a lawsuit in the civil courts, in the U.S. district courts, the SEC can seek a variety of remedies, such as civil monetary penalties, a return of illegally obtained profits, or a suspension of an individual from their role in the securities sphere. Now, to get into the administrative side a little bit, the SEC can also seek a variety of sanctions through administrative proceedings. Administrative proceedings are different from civil proceedings because they go before administrative law judges. This is kind of an entirely different aspect of our judicial system here in the U.S. So these judges are given the facts, they're given a little bit of evidence, and then they give an initial decision and recommendation. The SEC is then able to either affirm the administrative law judge's decision and recommendations, or they can reverse or remand. So to reverse it would mean to go a different direction from the decision completely, and then remand would be to have them consider what have the administrative law judges consider again the evidence that's been presented to them. Through an administrative action, the SEC may seek several different administrative sanctions. These include suspension or revocation of a broker-dealer or investment advisor registration, a cease and desist order, censures, bars from association with the securities industry, or civil monetary penalties or disgorgement.
Thank you for that, Madeline. It's certainly crucial to grasp the multifaceted nature of the US regulatory landscape. And I guess to allude to what you mentioned to earlier, you can't assume that success with one regulator guarantees compliance with others. Madeline, Alex, a big thank you to you both. Your expertise and insights have been invaluable. Thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thanks, Kate. I'm sure we'll be back soon.
You reached the end of another episode of the Legal Zeitgeist podcast. Connect with us at Zeidler.group to subscribe. Thank you for listening. The Legal Zeitgeist podcast is provided for information purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. Professional legal advice should be obtained before taking or refraining from any action as a result of the contents of this podcast. All rights reserved.